If I'm honest, my proposal to my wife this last summer did not go exactly to plan. I'll set the scene. Before the planned proposal, I decided to make that needed journey up to her parents in Hull to ask her dad if he minded if I married his daughter. Now, my family have a bit of sort of history in this area. My dad, when he asked my granddad if he could marry my mum, my granddad's daughter, my granddad said, "Which one?" So when it came to asking the question, I was a little bit, as you'd expect, a little bit nervous. So I decided that the right thing to do was to get a piece of paper and to jot down some notes. Now, somehow, this scrap of paper, after the proposal, after asking him, which he said yes to, this little scrap of paper ended up on the floor of my wife-to-be's house. And thankfully, it was her mum who found it and not her or her two brothers. The proposal itself, though, went even worse. It was well planned, but certainly poorly executed. The idea was perfect: a picnic in the park, listening to our song on the phone, the ring hidden in a sock, the warm sun on our backs as we ate a picnic in Regent's Park. However, the day itself was ruined firstly by weather, and secondly by those annoying people who got to the park first and found all the best spots, and thirdly by the untimely visit of a rat. Now, what we see in this passage is a proposal. This proposal is well planned. But other than well planned, it actually goes much better than mine. As we continue this fantastic story of Ruth, we get to chapter 3, which, in my opinion, is the sort of pinnacle chapter of this book, of this story. But it's not the husband-to-be planning the proposal, nor is it the wife-to-be, but it's the mother-in-law of the wife-to-be. And it's this unusual proposal that the story now gravitates. Now, I'm not going to spend too much time recapping so far. So if you haven't heard the story so far, listen to the podcasts that are available on the website. But I'm going to pick up on a couple of things that I think are really relevant that have happened in the stories before that I think are relevant to the story we're doing today. Now, as in all good stories, we've had hints of what will happen in this chapter in the last two chapters. First, if you remember, in chapter 1, verse 9, the distraught widow Naomi prays that her two newly widowed daughter-in-laws will find new husbands. But she asks first that they will go back to their homeland, find husbands and hope there. One sister, quick of a flash, is off on the bus back home. The second sister, Ruth, stays. In an incredible show of love, of dedication to Naomi, but also in faithfulness to her new God, she declares, "Your people will be my people, your gods will be my gods." Then in chapter 2, we move from scene 1 on the road to scene 2 in the field, which, as I see these two plants down here, we're quite prepared for. In the field, where we see the field owner Boaz, who shows unprecedented kindness to Ruth and to her mother-in-law Naomi. And Naomi realizes that this man is indeed a close relative. He is a guardian or a kinsman redeemer. So chapter 2 ends and chapter 3 begins with those key words ringing in our ears: kinsman redeemer, a guardian redeemer. And it's important, before we really head into this chapter, that we think a little bit about what it means, what this kinsman, this guardian redeemer is. So what exactly is a kinsman redeemer? Well, a kinsman redeemer was a close male relative who had the privilege or the responsibility to act for a relative who is in need of redemption. In this specific case, the role was to marry the widow and father a son on behalf of the passed away husband. Thus, the family name would be continued and the inheritance would not be lost. This kinsman redeemer was a role of rescue, an opportunity within God's law to rescue otherwise outcast women, a near relative who redeems those who would otherwise be lost. So then, as we dive into this particular passage, we find Naomi, knowing that Boaz is a kinsman redeemer, a close relative, making a plan. It's there for us in verses 1 to 4, if you look down with me as we go through that. So Naomi knows where Boaz is going to be that night, so winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Obviously, that's the place where all eligible bachelors hang out on their Thursday nights. So she recognizes also that a bit of a wash and a bit of perfume wouldn't go amiss for Ruth. The scent of barley and sweat from the day at work in the field probably isn't the most appropriate perfume. Naomi is then asked Ruth to head down to the threshing floor and wait and see where Boaz lies. Now that's kind of code for saying, just make sure you get the right guy. Then when he's fast asleep, head over, uncover his feet, and that's going to wake him up. As we all know, trying to sleep with cold feet is not an easy thing to do. And then finally, the plan is then left with Boaz. When he wakes up, Boaz will tell you what to do. He will tell you what to do. As we read this passage, it's always interesting to think about what we do with Naomi's plan. Naomi is not for the first time looking out for Ruth's interest. She recognizes that Boaz is this kinsman redeemer and attempts to orchestrate a meeting. This is kind of a private conversation, and these private conversations were not easy in that culture. You couldn't exactly sort of stick a post-it note on your person's computer or slip them an email. So she intervenes in the best way that she sees possible. But this isn't just about Ruth's interests. This is also about Naomi's interests. You see, of course, Ruth could have gone away and married anyone she wanted, a nice, rich young man from her own area to take care of her, but that would leave Naomi without a redeemer. So this is therefore a story, or is this therefore a story, I wonder, where we can defend parents who want to interfere with their children's relationships? I don't think we can, particularly if you don't want your children to have good excuses to go in and uncovering some handsome young man's feet. I am, however, as an aside, very happy and very grateful for the constant prayers of my parents and the occasional whispered word of concern that I might get a godly wife. And I'm sure many others are too. But this passage itself has much bigger fish to fry than merely an interest in our personal lives. You see, if this was merely a sort of Disney love story, we would see Naomi as that kind of crafty, smart fairy godmother who kind of weaves her way and works out the best way to do what she wants to do. If it were a moral tale, we would, depending on our interpretation and our morals, we would say, be a Naomi, or don't be a Naomi, or use your initiative like Ruth. But as we've seen, this tale is much bigger than Ruth, much bigger than Boaz, much bigger even than us. This is primarily a story about God. And if this is primarily a story about God, then what do we want to say? We want to say God is in control. To me, that seems to be the headline of the whole of the book of Ruth. God is in control. Whatever Naomi's intentions, his intention is to redeem Ruth and therefore redeem Naomi. And as we'll see shortly, to ultimately redeem all mankind. And God's sovereignty can be particularly seen in the story throughout the whole of the book. And we're not going to go into that, but look back to those other chapters and see where God's sovereignty, God's plan, often it comes in sentences like, as it turned out, God is in control. Secondly, then, we turn from Naomi's plan to Ruth's kindness. And we've seen this throughout the whole of the story. In fact, if the overriding message of this story has not been God is in control, then it's, isn't Ruth incredible? No wonder they call the book Ruth. She's some sort of superwoman, isn't she? A widow who, rather than seeking after her own gain, finding her own husband, chooses to leave her own people, her own town, her comfort, go to this unknown land with a woman who describes herself as bitter and afflicted. And now with Naomi meddling in her affairs, what is Ruth's response going to be? Well, look down with me at verses 5 and 6. This is what Ruth answers. I will do whatever you say, Ruth answered. So she went to the threshing floor and did everything that her mother-in-law told her to do. Here's the thing though. Ruth acts not only out of her own personal desire for a husband or family. Ruth's actions are so much kinder than this. Ruth knows that she is now part of the covenant family of God's. Following her roadside conversion, your God will be my God, your people will be my people. Ruth realizes that she's been welcomed in to not just a family, but a great people in relationship with a great God. And it's out of kindness to that family and out of covenant faithfulness to God that she does everything her mother-in-law tells her. So back then to the threshing floor, Boaz wakes up, startled it seems, by his cold feet, and is shocked to discover, as you would be, a woman lying at his feet. His reaction is much like many of ours would be. Who are you? It's not that he doesn't know Ruth, but the darkness and her clothing and maybe the drink that he's had before going to bed make him a little unsure about what is going on. But his confusion doesn't last long, does it? Look down at verse 9. Ruth answers, "I am your servant, Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer or a kinsman redeemer." Boaz's response shows us that he knows exactly what she's asking. Look at the response in verse 10 and 11. "The Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." You see, Boaz is in no doubt what's going on is a marriage proposal. We know, and Boaz knows, that Ruth is, in verse 11, a woman of noble character. She's a proper sort of Proverbs 31 woman. Nothing untoward, just to sort of make it clear, nothing untoward is going on here, as much as our sort of sexualized 21st century culture would like us to think. This is a genuine proposal of marriage. And a kind one at that. Boaz's response almost is sort of like, me, you want to marry me? You could have gone after all these young, attractive men, but you chose me? That's kindness. But here's the thing, Ruth knows that for the sake of her family, for the sake of Naomi's name, she needs to marry a kinsman redeemer. So she gives herself away, first in her commitment to Naomi, and secondly in her commitment to Boaz. For the second time in the story, someone says, "I will do all that you ask." First Ruth to Naomi, now Boaz to Ruth. The story seems to be going to have a happy ending. Wedding bells, or whatever the Bethlehem equivalent of wedding bells were, are going to be ringing in our ears. Closed scene, fade out, romantic music. Let's end the story there. Well, not quite yet. You see, there's a bit of a problem, and it is in light of this problem, I think, that we see the integrity of Boaz. And I wonder, just as we look at this, is it in light of unseen problems that we see our integrity or lack thereof? As I've been looking at this passage over the last week, I've been struck again and again by the integrity of this man, Boaz. Just look down as we finish at verses 11 to 15. First, Boaz explains that he is in fact not the closest kinsman redeemer. There's another chap who's a closer kin than him. And Boaz wants to give this man a fair shout. Back in verse 10, he noted Ruth's kindness, but he's not about to take advantage of that kindness at the expense of another. But neither is he going to wait around. He will act immediately, verse 12. In the morning, if he wants to redeem, then good, let him redeem. But if not, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. If he's not keen, then by golly, I am. But it's his right, his first right, and I'm a man of integrity. More than this, though, Boaz is concerned about Ruth's integrity. And we'll skim over this quickly, but how she will be seen by others. Let's just remind ourselves briefly of the situation that Ruth and Boaz are in. Because of Naomi's methods, and not, I might add, her motive, Boaz is faced with this young woman on the floor late at night of the threshing floor, surrounded by men who, after a nice season of harvest, have probably had a few post-harvest celebration beers, are in good spirits. His options are limited. He could have Ruth stay, and then as she leaves, try and explain to these men looking on that actually it's not what it looks like, or try and sort of push away those rumors of the night on the threshing floor. Or he could send her off into the dark, but the dangers there might be more than the dangers in the threshing floor. What does he do, though? He suggests that she gets some sleep, but in the morning, as verse 14 says, before anyone could be recognized, he'll send her on the way. So she sleeps at his feet, and as promised, he thinks mainly of her and not of himself. And in the morning, he sends her on away, saying, "No one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor." Given this not ideal situation, Boaz acts with incredible integrity. He does the best that he can for the sake of this incredible widow. So Ruth heads back to Naomi, not with a ring or a necklace, but a bag full of barley. Fair enough, nice present. She shares the tale of the evening's events with Naomi, her mother-in-law. Nothing is hidden. And Naomi, knowing the great character of Boaz, says, "Wait, my daughter," verse 18, "wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today." She knows that Boaz will be up early in the morning, rising early to visit the kinsman redeemer. settling the issue and ensuring that Ruth or Naomi, neither of them have to wait to see their future decided. I wonder how different our lives would be, how different our workplace would be if we showed as much integrity as Boaz and as much kindness as Ruth. Boaz's desire to obey God leads him not to cut corners, but also not to wait till tomorrow for something that could be done today. I wonder how good a witness we would be if we were around the office working a little bit like Boaz, with Boaz-like integrity, or known amongst our friends as being as self-sacrificingly kind as Ruth, or as willing to act on the word, our promises, as both Ruth and Boaz. But I don't want to make this simply about Boaz, because we completely miss the point. We started with the idea of a kinsman redeemer, and we'll finish with it. You see, incredibly, as we read this story, we see that Boaz is a foreshadowing of our kinsman redeemer, Jesus, who, according to Hebrews, became one with us in everything except our sinfulness, in order that he might redeem us. He became both kin, a descendant of Adam and a close relative, and a willing redeemer, paying the price for us to redeem us. As Boaz offers to redeem Ruth, and through Ruth, Naomi, and the whole family name, so Jesus offers redemption of his repentant people. As Ruth lay at the feet of Boaz, so we lie at the feet of Christ. As Ruth asked to be covered with Boaz's garment, so we are covered with the redeeming blood of the Lamb. As Ruth walks home holding the gifts of a kinsman redeemer, so we walk back up Regent Street with the wonderful gifts that Christ has given us. Ruth comes to Boaz as a foreigner with absolutely nothing. We come to Christ as foreigners with nothing. Here's the thing. If any one of us thinks that we can go to Jesus with any more, go to our kinsman redeemer with any more than Ruth and Naomi could go to with their kinsman redeemer, we're simply deluded. As I walk up to Jesus and say, Lord, look at me. Look at what I've got to offer. Look at my gifts, my talents, my abilities. Look at my 2-1 from university. Look at how good a football player I am. Look at how successful a banker I am, or what I've done with the company's finances. Look at the book that I've written, or my church attendance, or how well my kids are performing at school. That is as ridiculous as Ruth walking up to Boaz and saying, look at me, a widow, a foreigner, no heir, no money, no hope, and a name that will soon be written out of history. Look at me. Do you want to marry this? Ruth can offer nothing, and neither, when all is said and done, can we. And yet, what is Boaz's phenomenal response? I will do for you all you ask. We'll finish and pray there. Lord, we just thank you for this incredible passage, and we thank you that this points ultimately to a Redeemer, Lord. This incredible story that we just wait for an ending to, we know points ultimately to you. And we pray that as we leave and go into the workplace and go into the rest of our week, that you'll be reminding us as the great gifts of your kinsman Redeemer. In your name, amen.